Chapter 24. Karaskand. They strike down the weak and call it justice. They ungird their loins and call it reparation. They bark like dogs and call it reason. Antillus, on the folly of men. Late winter, 4112, year of the Tusk, Karaskand. Rain fell and wind swept skirts of gray. It sizzled across the rooftops and the streets. It gurgled through the gutters, rinsing away flakes of dried blood. It pattered against the still-skinned skulls of the dead. It both kissed the uppermost twigs of ancient Umiaki and plummeted through his darkest hollows. A million beads of water, converging at the forks between branches, twining into strings, threading the darkness with lines of glittering white. Soon rivulets spiraled down the hemp rope and dropped like marbles along the bronze ring, whence they branched across skin, both living and dead. Across the Kalal, thousands ran for cover, shielding themselves with wool cloaks and mantles. Others wailed, held out their hands, beseeching, wondering what the rains omened. The lightning blinded them, the waters bit their cheeks, and the thunder muttered secrets they could not fathom. They held out their hands beseeching. His sleep was fitful, haunted by dreams of Dunyain words and Dunyain deeds. You, the abomination said, still command the ears of the great. Serwe slumped in Sarcellus's arms, showering blood. Remember the secret of battle. Remember. Nayor woke to rain and whispers. The secret of battle. The ears of the great. Not finding Proyas at his compound, he rode with all due haste to the Sapatishah's palace on the Kneeling Heights, where the prince's terrified steward had said he could be found. The rain had started to trail by the time he reached the first echelons of residences about the base of the heights. Momentary sunlight cast fingers of brilliance across the otherwise dark city. As he urged his famished mount upward, Nayor cast a look over his shoulder, saw the sun battle through clouds of mountainous black. From height to height, across the confusion of the bowl all the way to the dark and hazy line of the triamic walls, pools of rainwater flashed white, like 1,000 coins of silver. He dismounted in the anarchy of the palace's outer campus. Every heartbeat, it seemed, saw another band of armed riders clack through the gates. With the exception of the Galioth guardsmen and several near-skeletal Kianin slaves, everyone carried either the mark or the air of caste nobility. Nayor recognized many from previous councils, though for some reason none dared to hail him. He followed the Enrithi into the shadows of the entry hall, where he fairly collided with a crimson-clad Gedeki. The Palatine halted, stared at him agog.
"Sweet Sejanus," he exclaimed. "Are you well? Was there more fighting on the walls?"
Nayor looked down to his chest. Red had soaked the white of his tunic almost to his iron-plated girdle.
"Your throat's been cut," Gedeki said wondrously. "Where's Proyas?"
Nayor snapped.
"With the other dead,"
the Palatine said darkly, gesturing to the files of men disappearing into the palace's frescoed inner sanctums. Nayor found himself following a band of wild-tempered Thunieri, led by Yalgrot de Srunkhamer, his flaxen braids adorned with iron nails bent like tusks and the shrunken heads of heathen. At one point, the giant jerked his head about and glared at him. Nayor matched his gaze, his soul boiling with thoughts of murder.
"Usharutka!"
The man snorted and turned away, smiling at the guttural laughter of his compatriots. Nayor spat on the walls, then stared wildly about. Wherever he looked, it seemed, he saw men glance away.
"All of them. All of them."
Somewhere, he could hear the tribesmen of the Utamot whisper,
"Weeper."
The vaulted corridor ended in bronze doors which had been propped open with two busts kicked face down onto the carpets. Old Sapatishahs carved in diorite, Nayor imagined, or relics of the Nansur occupation. Through the doors he found himself in a great chamber, shouldering his way through a crowd of milling caste nobles. The air hummed with reverberating voices.
"Faggot weeper!"
The room was circular and far more ancient in construction than the greater palace, Kyrenian or Shigeki perhaps. A table, carved of what looked like white gypsum, dominated the central floor, which was covered by a magnificent rug of copper and gold embroidery. Just beyond the rug's outer fringe, a series of concentric tiers rose in the fashion of amphitheaters, providing an unobstructed view of the table below. Constructed of monumental blocks, the encircling wall soared above the back tier, set with sconces and adorned with the distinctive streamer-like tapestries favored by the Kianin. A pointed dome of corbelled stone loomed overhead, hanging, it seemed, without the luxury of mortar or vaults. A series of wells about its base provided light, diffuse and white, while high above the central table, heathen banners swayed in unseen drafts. Nayor found Proyas standing near the table, his head bent in concentration as he listened to a stocky man in blue and gray. The man's robes were soiled about the knees, and compared with the rakish frames of those about him, he looked almost obscenely fat. Someone shouted from the tiers, and the man turned to the sound, revealing the five white lines that marred his unplaited beard. Nayor stared incredulously. It was the sorcerer. The dead sorcerer. What happened here?
Proyas!
He shouted, for some reason loath to come any closer.
We must speak!
The Kunrayan prince looked about, and upon locating him, scowled much as Gaideki had. The sorcerer, however, continued speaking, and Nayor found himself waved away with a harried gesture.
Proyas!
He barked, but the prince spared him only a furious glance.
Fool,
Nayor thought. The siege could be broken. He knew what they must do. The secret of battle, he remembered. He found a spot on the tiers with the other lesser names and their retinues, and watched the great names settle into their usual bickering. The hunger in Karaskand had reached such straits that even the great among the Inrithi had been reduced to eating rats and drinking the blood of their horses. The leaders of the Holy War had grown hollow-cheeked and gaunt, and the hauberks of many, particularly those who'd been fat, hung loosely from their frames so they resembled juveniles playing in their father's armor. They looked at once foolish and tragic, possessed of the shambling pageantry of dying rulers. As Karaskan's titular king, Sauban sat in a large black lacquered seat at the head of the table. He leaned forward, gripping the arms of his chair, as though preparing to exercise a preeminence no one else recognized. To his right reclined Confis, who looked about with the lolling impatience of someone forced to treat lessers as equals. To his left sat Prince Scaled's surviving brother, Hulwarga the Limper, who'd represented Thunieres ever since Scaled had succumbed to the hemoplexy. Next to Hulwarga sat Gothjelk, the grizzled Earl of Agansinor, his wiry beard as unkempt as usual, his combative look more menacing. To his left sat Proyas, his manner both wary and thoughtful. Though he spoke to the sorcerer, who sat on a smaller seat immediately next to him, his eyes continued to search the faces of those about the table. And lastly, positioned between Proyas and Confis, sat the decorous Palatine of Antanamera, Kinjoza, whom, according to rumor, the Scarlet Spires had installed as interim king regent in the wake of Kefaramuni's demise, also to the hemoplexy.
Where's Gotian?
Proyas demanded of the others.
Perhaps,
Ikuri Confis said with droll sarcasm.
The Grand Master learned it was a sorcerer you'd summoned us to hear. Shrile knights, I fear, tend to be rather shrile.
Proyas called out to Sarcellus, who sat on the lowest tier, clad ankle to wrist in the white shrile vestments he typically wore to council. Bowing low to the great names, the knight commander professed ignorance as to his Grand Master's whereabouts. Nayor looked down at his right forearm while he spoke, not so much listening to as memorizing the hateful timbre of the man's voice. He watched the veins and scars ripple as he clenched and unclenched his fist. When he blinked, he saw the knife gashing Serwe's throat, the shining spilling red. Nayor scarcely heard the procedural arguments that followed, something regarding the legalities of continuing without the Holy Shrya's representative. Instead, he watched Sarcellus. Ignoring the great names and their debate, the dog was engrossed in council with some other Shrile knight. The spidery network of red lines still marred his sensuous face, though much fainter than when Nayor had last seen the man with Proyas and Confis. His expression appeared calm, but his large brown eyes seemed troubled and distant, as though he pondered matters that rendered this spectacle irrelevant.
What was it the Dunyane had said?
Lie made flesh. Nayor was hungry, very hungry. He hadn't eaten a true meal for several days now, and the gnawing in his belly lent a curious edge to everything he witnessed, as though his soul no longer had the luxury of fat thoughts and fat impressions. The taste of his horse's blood was fresh upon his lips. For a mad moment, he found himself wondering what Sarcellus's blood would taste like. Would it taste like lies? Did lies have a taste? Everything since Serwe's murder seemed unclear, and no matter how hard Nayor tried, he could not separate his days from his nights. Everything overflowed, spilled into everything else. Everything had been fouled, fouled, and the Dunyane wouldn't shut up. And then this morning, for no reason whatsoever, he'd simply understood. He'd remembered the secret of battle.
I told him. I showed him the secret.
And the cryptic words that Kellis had spoken on the ruined heights of the Citadel became plain as lead. The hunt need not end. He understood the Dunyane's plan, or part of it. If only Proyas would have listened. Suddenly the shouting about the table trailed, as did the rumbling along the tiers. An astonished hush fell across the ancient chamber, and Nayor saw the sorcerer, Akamian, standing at Proyas's side, glaring at the others with a grim fearlessness of an exhausted man.
"Since my presence so offends you," he said in a loud, clear voice, "I will not mince words. You have all made a ghastly mistake, a mistake which must be undone for the sake of the Holy War and for the sake of the world."
He paused to appraise their scowling faces.
"You must free Anassarimber Kellis."
Cries of outrage and reproach exploded from those about the table and those along the tiers alike. Nayor watched, riveted to his seat, to his martial posture. He did not, it seemed, need to speak to Proyas after all.
"Listen to him!"
The Khonryan prince screeched over the warring voices. Astonished by the savagery of this outburst, the entire room seemed to catch its breath. But Nayor was already breathless.
"He seeks to free him."
But did this mean they also knew the Dunyane's plan? In the councils of the Holy War, Proyas had always played the sober foil for the excessive passions of the other great names. To hear the man scream in this way was a dismaying thing. The other great names fell silent, like children chastised not by their father, but by what they'd made their father do.
"This is no travesty," Proyas continued. "This is no joke meant to gall or offend. More, far more than our lives depend on what decision we make here today. I ask you to decide with me, as does any man with arguments to make. But I demand that you listen before making that decision. And this demand, I think, is no real demand at all, since listening without bias, without bigotry, is simply what all wise men do."
Nayor glanced across the chamber, noted that Sarcellus watched the drama as intently as any of the others. He even angrily waved at his retinue to fall silent. Standing before the great and wreathy lords, the sorcerer looked haggard and impoverished in his soiled gear, and he appeared hesitant, as though only now realizing how far he'd strayed from his element. But with his girth and unbroken health, he looked a king in the trappings of a beggar. The men on the tusk, on the other hand, looked like wraiths decked in the trappings of kings.
"You've asked," Akamian called out, "why the god punishes the Holy War, what cancer pollutes us, what disease of spirit has stirred the god's wrath against us. But there are many cancers. For the faithful, schoolmen such as myself are one such cancer. But the Shrya himself has sanctioned our presence among you. So you looked elsewhere, and found the man many call the warrior prophet, and you asked yourself, what if this man is false? Would that not be enough for the god's anger to burn against us, a false prophet?"
He paused, and Nayor could see that he swallowed behind pursed lips.
I haven't come to tell you whether Prince Kellis is truly a prophet, nor even whether he's a prince of anything at all. I've come rather to warn you of a different cancer, one that you've overlooked, though indeed some of you know of its presence. There are spies among us, my lords.
A collective murmur momentarily filled the chamber.
Abominations that wear false faces of skin.
The sorcerer bent beneath the table, hoisted a fouled sack of some kind. In a single motion, he unfurled it across the table, something like silvery eels about a blackened cabbage rolled onto the polished surface, came to rest against an impossible reflection. A severed head? Lie made flesh. A cacophony of exclamations reverberated beneath the chamber's dome.
Deceit! Blasphemous deceit!
It's madness. We cannot.
But what could it?
Surrounded by astonished cries and brandished fists, Nayur watched Sarcella stand, then press his way through the clamor toward the exit. Once again, Nayur glimpsed the inflamed lines that marred the Night Commander's face. Suddenly, he realized he'd seen the pattern before. But where? Where? Anwarat. Serwe bloodied and screaming. Kellis naked, his groin smeared red, his face jerking open like fingers about a coal. A Kellis who was not Kellis. Overcome by a trembling wolfish hunger, Nayur stood and hurried to follow. At last he fathomed everything the Dunyane had said to him the day he was denounced by the great names, the day of Serwe's death. The memory of Kellis's voice pierced the thunder of the assembled Enrithi. Lie made flesh. A name. Sarcellus's name. Cenerses fell to his knees just beyond the raised threshold of the entryway, then pressed his head to the faux carpet carved into the stone. The Kianin, like most other peoples, considered certain thresholds sacred, but rather than anoint them on the appropriate days as did the Ainani, they adorned them with elaborately carved renditions of reed-woven rugs. It was, Hanamanu Eliazarus had decided, a worthy custom. The passage from place to place, he thought, should be marked in stone. Notice needed to be served.
Grandmaster, Cenerses gasped, throwing back his head. I bear word from Lord Kinjosa.
Eliazarus had expected the man, but not his agitation. His skin crawling, he looked to his secretaries and ordered them from the room with a vague wave. Like most men of power in Karaskand, Eliazarus had found himself very interested in the specifics of his dwindling supplies. Everything, it seemed, had conspired against him these past months. Karaskand's slow starvation had reached such a pitch that even sorcerers of rank went hungry. The most desperate had started boiling the leather binding and vellum pages of those texts that had survived the desert. The most glorious school in the Three Seas had been reduced to eating their books. The Scarlet Spires suffered with the rest of the Holy War, so much so that they now discussed meeting with the great names and declaring that henceforth the Scarlet Spires would war openly with the Enrithi, something that had been unthinkable mere weeks ago. Wagers beget wagers, each typically more desperate than the last. In order to preserve his first wager, Eliazarus now must make a second, one that would expose the Scarlet Spires to the deadly trinkets of the Padi Raja's Thesji bowmen, who'd so decimated the Imperial Sake, the Emperor's own school, during the Jihads. And this, he knew, could very well weaken the Scarlet Spires beyond any hope of overcoming the Kishorum.
Korei!
Accursed things! The tears of the god cared nothing for those who brandished them, in Enrithi or Fainim, so long as they weren't sorcerers. Apparently one didn't need to interpret the god correctly to wield him. Wager upon wager, desperation upon desperation. The situation had become so dire, things had been stretched so tight, that any news, Eliazarus realized, could break the back of his school. The more pinched the note, the more the string could snap. Even the words of this slave soldier kneeling at his feet could signal their doom. Eliazarus fought for his breath.
What have you learned, Captain?
Proyas has brought the mandate schoolmen to the council, the man said.
Eliazarus felt his skin pimple. Ever since hearing of their mission's destruction in Iothea, he'd found himself dreading the Mandati's return.
You mean Drusus Akamian?
He's come to exact vengeance.
Yes, Grandmaster, he's... Has he come alone? Are there any others?
Please, please. Akamian on his own they could easily manage. A corps of mandate sorcerers, however, could prove ruinous. Too many had died already.
No more. We can afford to lose no more. No, he seems to be alone, but...
Does he bring charges against us? Does he malign our exalted school?
He speaks of skin spies, Grandmaster. Skin spies!
Eleazarus stared uncomprehending. He says they walk among us, Cinerces continued.
He says they're everywhere. He even brought one of their heads in a sack.
So hideous, Master, that such a thing... But I forget myself. Lord King Joseph himself sent me. He seeks instruction. The mandate sorcerer is demanding the great names free the warrior prophet.
Prince Kellis? Eleazarus blinked, still struggling to make sense of the man's blather.
Yes, yes, his friend. They were friends before. The mandate fiend was his teacher.
Free?
Eleazarus managed to say with some semblance of reserve.
What are his grounds?
Cinerces' eyes bulged from his half-starved face.
The skin spies! He claims this warrior prophet is the only one who can see them.
The warrior prophet. Since marching from the desert, they'd watched the man with growing trepidation, especially when it became apparent how many of their Javra were secretly taking the whelming and becoming Zhao Dunyani. When Ikuri Confus had come to him promising to destroy the man, Eleazarus had commanded Kinjosa to support the Exalt General in all ways, though he still fretted over the possibility of war between the Orthodox and the Zhao Dunyani. He thought the matter of Anasarimber Kellis's fate, at least, had been sealed.
What do you mean?
He argues that since only this prophet can see them, he must be released so that the holy war might be cleansed. Only this way, he claims, will the god turn his anger from us.
As an old master at Jinan, Eleazarus was loath to allow his true passions to surface in the presence of his slaves, but these past days had been very hard. The face he showed Cinerces was bewildered. He seemed an old man who'd grown very afraid of the world.
Muster as many men as you can, he said distantly. Immediately!
Cinerces fled.
Spies. Everywhere, spies. And if he couldn't find them, if he couldn't find them...
The Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires would speak to this warrior prophet, to this holy man who could see what was hidden in their midst. Throughout his life, Eleazarus, a sorcerer who could peer into the world's smokiest recesses, had wondered what it was the holy thought they saw. Now he knew. Malice. It hungered, the thing called Sarcellus, for blood, for fucking things living and dead. But more than anything, it hungered for consummation. All of it, from its anus to the sham it called its soul, was bent to the ends of its creators. Everything was twisted to the promise of climax, to the jet of hot salt. But the architects had been shrewd, so heartlessly astute when they laid its foundations. So few things, the rarest of circumstances, could deliver that release. Killing the woman, the Dunyane's wife, had been such a moment. The mere recollection was enough to make its phallus arch against its breeches, gasp like a fish. And now that the mandate sorcerer, accursed Chigra, had returned seeking to deliver the Dunyane, the promise, the fury, it had known instantly what it must do. As it strode from the Sapatashah's palace, the air swam with its yearning, the sun shimmered with its hate. Although subtle beyond reason, the thing called Sarcellus walked a far simpler world than that walked by men. There was no war of competing passions, no need for discipline or denial. It lusted only to execute the will of its authors. In appeasing its hunger, it appeased the good. So it had been forged, such was the cunning of its manufacture. The warrior prophet must die. There were no interfering passions, no fear, no remorse, no competing lusts. It would kill Anasarimber Kellis before he could be saved, and in so doing, find ecstasy. Nayor need only see the route Sarcellus took down the Kneeling Heights to know where the dog was headed. The man rode into the bowl, which meant he rode to the temple complex where Gotian and the Shrial Knights were stationed, and where the Dunyane and Serwe hung from black-limbed Umiaki. Nayor spat, then hollered for his horse. By the time he clattered free of the outer campus, he could no longer find the man. He barreled downward through the welter of structures that crowded the slopes below the Sapatishah's palace. Despite his mount's perilous condition, he whipped it to a gallop. They raced past spiked garden walls, along abandoned shop fronts and beneath looming tenements, turned only where the streets seemed to descend. Kasakis, he remembered, lay near the bottom of the bowl. The very air seemed to buzz with omens. Over and over, like a shard of glass in his stomach, images of Kellis cycled through his thoughts. It seemed he could feel the man's hand clamped about his neck, holding him, impossibly, over the precipice in the Hethanta Mountains. For a panicked moment, he even found it difficult to breathe, to swallow. The sensation passed only when he ran his fingertips along the clotted gash about his throat, his most recent Swazond.
How can he afflict me so?
But then, that was Moengus's lesson. The Dunyane made disciples of all men, whether they revered him or no. One need only breathe.
Even my hate, Nayor thought. Even my hate he uses to his advantage.
Though his heart rankled at this, it rankled far more at the thought of losing Moengus. Kellis had spoken true those long months past in the Utamot camp. His heart had only one quarry, and it could not be fed on surrogates. He was bound to the Dunyane as the Dunyane was bound to Serwe's corpse, bound by the cutting ropes of an unconquerable hate. Any shame, any indignity, he would bear any injury, commit any atrocity to whet his vengeance. He would see the whole world burn before he would surrender his hate. Hate! That was the obsessive heart of his strength, not his blade, not his frame, his neck-breaking, wife-striking, shield-cracking hate. Hatred had secured him the White Yaksh. Hatred had banded his body with the holy scars. Hatred had preserved him from the Dunyane when they crossed the steppe. Hatred had inured him to the claims these outlanders made on his heart. Hatred and hatred alone had kept him sane. Of course, the Dunyane had known this. After Moengus, Nayor had fled to the codes of the people, thinking they could preserve his heart. Having been cheated of them, they'd seemed all the more precious, akin to water in times of great thirst. For years he'd whipped himself down the tracks followed by his tribesmen, whipped himself bloody. To be a man, the memorialist said, was to take and not to be taken, to enslave and not to be enslaved. So he would be first among warriors, the most violent of all men. For this was the most paramount of the unwritten laws, a man, a true man, conquered, and did not suffer himself to be used. Hence the torment of his pact with Kellis. All this time, Nayor had jealously guarded his heart and soul, spitting upon the fiend's every word, never thinking that the man could rule him by manipulating the circumstances about him. The Dunyane had unmanned him no differently than he had these Enrithi fools.
Moengus. He named him Moengus. My son!
What better way to gull him? What better way to gull? He had been used. Even now, thinking these very thoughts, the Dunyane used him. But it did not matter. There were no codes. There was no honor. The world between men was as trackless as the steppe, as the desert. There were no men, only beasts, clawing, craving, mewling, braying, gnawing at the world with their hungers, beaten like bears into dancing to this absurd custom or that. All these thousands, these men of the tusk, killed and died in the name of delusion. Save hunger, nothing commanded the world. This was the secret of the Dunyane. This was their monstrosity. This was their fascination. Ever since Moengus had abandoned him, Nayor had thought himself the traitor. Always one thought too many. Always one lust, one hunger. But now he knew that the treachery dwelt in the chorus of condemning voices, the recriminations that howled out from nowhere, calling him names, such hateful names.
She was my proof! Liars, fools, he would make them see! Any shame, any indignity, he would strangle infants in their cribs, he would kneel beneath the fall of hot seed, he would see his hate through. There was no honor. Only wrath and destruction. Only hate. The hunt need not end.
The abandoned tenements fell away, and Nayor found himself galloping across one of Karaskan's bazaars. Corpses, little more than sodden bundles of skin, bone, and fabric, flashed beneath. Halfway across the grim expanse, he spied the obelisks of Kasakas, rising above a low scarp of buildings. After passing through a complex of several mud-brick storehouses, decrepit to the point of collapse, he found an avenue he recognized and whipped his horse along a row of what looked like fire-gutted residences. After a sharp right, his mount was forced by momentum to leap an overturned piss basin, a great stone bowl that must have belonged to a nearby launderer. He felt, before he heard, his Umarnan white throw a shoe. The horse screamed, faltered, then limped to a halt, apparently lamed. Cursing the thing, he leapt to the ground and began sprinting, knowing there was no way for him to overtake the Knight Commander now. Beyond the first turn, however, the white kalal miraculously yawned wide before him, crisscrossed by the water-soaked joints between paving stones and darkened by crowds of starving thousands. At first, he didn't know whether he should be dismayed or heartened by the sight of so many Inrithi. Most of them, he imagined, would be Zaudunyani, which might prevent Sarcellus from killing the Dunyain outright, if that was what the man in fact intended to do. Thrusting his way between startled onlookers, Nayor gazed across the crowds, searching in vain for the Shrial Knight. He saw the tree, Umiyaki, in the distance, dark and hunched against a hazy band of colonnades and temple facades. The sudden certainty that the Dunyain was dead struck him breathless.
It's over.
It seemed he'd never suffered such a harrowing thought. He frantically peered across the distances. The unobscured sun was boiling steam from the damp masses. He looked to the men crowding about him and felt a sudden dizzying relief. Many chanted or sang, others simply looked to the branches reaching skyward. All seemed anxious with hunger, but nothing more.
He lives still, or there would be a riot.
Nayor barged his way forward, was shocked to find the half-starved Inrithi scrambling from his path. He heard voices cry out, Skilvendi! Not in salute, as they had at Anwarat, but as a curse or a prayer. Soon a great train of men followed him, some jeering, others crying out in exultation. Every face, it seemed, turned to his passage. A broad lane opened before him, reaching nearly all the way to the black tree.
Skilvendi!
The men of the Tusk shouted.
Skilvendi!
As before, Shrial Knights guarded the tree, only now arrayed in ranks some 3 or 4 men deep, a battle line in effect. Mounted patrols waded through the near distance. Alone among the Inrithi, the Knights of the Tusk had refused to don Kianine garments, so they looked threadbare in their tattered gold and white surcoats. Their helms and chainmail, however, still gleamed in the sunlight. As he approached them, Nayor spied Sarcellus standing with Gotian amid a clot of other Shrial officers. The forward Shrial knights recognized him and granted him a wide, if suspicious, berth as he strode toward Sarcellus and the Grand Master. The two men seemed to be arguing. Umiyaki reared behind them, branching dark across sea-blue skies. Glancing across the great mat of leaves, Nayor glimpsed the ring hanging beneath Umiyaki's chapped bowers. He saw Serwe and the Dunyain slowly spinning, like two sides of a coin.
How can she be dead? Because of you, the Dunyain whispered. Weeper. But why this moment?
Nayor heard the Grand Master cry over the growing thunder of the masses.
Because!
Nayor boomed in his mightiest battlefield voice.
He bears a grudge no man can fathom.
Despite the added censers the great names had summoned, Akamian found himself gagging at the stench of the thing. He explained how the limbs folded into a sheath, even propping the rotted head to demonstrate the way two limbs fit about a viscous eye socket. Save the odd exclamation of disgust, the assembled caste nobles watched in mute horror. At some point, a slave had offered him an orange-scented kerchief. When he could tolerate no more, he pressed it to his face and gestured for the hideous thing's removal. For several moments, astonished silence ruled the ancient council chamber. The censers hissed and steamed, fogging the nightmarish air. Smeared across the table, the thing's residue, which resembled black mold, continued to reek.
"So this," Confis finally said, "is the reason we must free the deceiver."
Akamian stared at the man, sensing some kind of verbal trap. He'd known from the start that Confis would be his primary adversary. Proyas had warned him, saying he'd never encountered anyone as formidable in the ways of Jinan. Rather than answer, Akamian decided to draw him out, to reveal his role in these weighty matters.
"I must discredit him."
"The time for playing your peers for fools is at an end, Ikuri."
The exiled general leaned back in his chair. He drew lazy fingertips across the imperial sun stamped on the cuirass of his field armor, as though to remind Akamian of the koray that lay hidden beneath. It was a gesture as good as any sneer.
"You make it sound," Proyas said, "as though he already knows about these things."
"He does."
"The sorcerer refers to ancient history,"
Confis replied. He'd been wearing his blue general's cloak in the traditional Nansor fashion, thrown forward over his left shoulder. He now cast it back with a brisk motion, letting it trail across the copper carpet.
"Some time ago, back when the Holy War still camped about Momum's walls, my uncle discovered that his prime council was in truth one of these things."
"Skaeus?" Proyas exclaimed.
"Are you saying Skaeus was one of these skin spies?"
"None other. Since he proved improbably difficult to restrain for someone so aged, my uncle summoned his imperial sake. When they insisted no sorcery was involved, I was sent to fetch the good blasphemer, Akamian here, to confirm their assessment. Things became..."
He paused, then actually had the temerity to wink at Akamian.
"Messy."
"So?"
Gathiel cried in his gruff manner.
"Was there any sorcery?"
"No," Akamian replied. "And that's the very thing that makes them so deadly. If they were sorcerous artifacts, they'd be quickly uncovered. As it stands, they're impossible to detect. And this," he said, turning to glare at the exalt general, "is precisely what these things have to do with an Asarimber Kellis. Only he can see them."
Several shouts rang beneath the Korbel dome.
"How do you know this?"
Holwarga asked. Akamian stiffened, once again seeing Kellis and Serwe swaying beneath the black tree. "He told me."
"Told you?"
Gothyelk growled.
"When? When?"
"But what are they?" Kinjoza said.
"He's right," Saban exclaimed. This is the cancer that pollutes us. It's as I said all along. The warrior prophet has come to cleanse us."
"You move too fast,"
Confis snapped.
"You gloss over the most important questions."
"Indeed," Proyas said. "Such as why, when you knew these things were among us, you said nothing to the council."
"Please,"
the exalt general replied, his brows knitted in derision.
"What was I to do? For all we know, several of these creatures sit among us this very moment."
He looked to the rapt faces, mostly bearded, rising around them.
"Among you, on the tiers," he called with a sweep of his hand, "or even about this very table."
A concerned rumble broke across the room.
"So tell me," Confis continued, "given the sorcerer's own estimation of these things, whom could I trust? You heard what he said. They're impossible to detect. I did all that I could, in fact, do."
He turned his sly eyes to Akamian, though he continued speaking to his fellow great names.
"I watched carefully, and when I at last knew who the lead agent was, I acted."
Akamian bolted erect in his chair. He opened his mouth to protest, but it was too late.
"Who?"
Kinjoza, Gothyelk, and Holwarga cried out in near unison. Confis shrugged.
Why, the man who calls himself the warrior prophet. Who else?
A single jeer pealed through the air, only to be shouted down by a chorus of rebukes.
Nonsense! Akamian cried. This is rank foolishness!
The exult general's eyebrows popped up, as though amazed that something so obvious could be overlooked.
But you just said that only he could see these abominations, did you not? Yes, but then tell us, how does he see them?
Caught unawares, Akamian could only stare at the man. Never, it seemed, had he come to loathe someone so quickly.
Well? The answer, Confis said, seems plain enough to me. He sees them because he knows who they are!
Exclamations rang out. Flummoxed, Akamian looked up across the raucous tears, glancing from face to bearded face. Suddenly he realized that what Confis had said moments earlier was true. Even now, skin spies watched him. He was certain of it. The consult watched him and laughed. He found himself clutching the table's edge.
So how, Saban was crying, did he know I would prevail on the plains of Mangetta? How did he know where to find water in desert sands? How does he know the truth in men's hearts? Because he's the warrior prophet,
someone bellowed from the tears.
Truth-bearer, light-bringer, the salvation of... Blasphemy!
Gothyelk roared, beating the table twice with his great fist.
He is false! False! There can be no more prophets! Sejanus is the true voice of God, the only... How can you say that?
Saban said, as though mourning a wayward brother.
How many times... He's ensorcelled you!
Confis shouted in the tones of a high imperial officer.
Bewitched you all!
When the uproar abated somewhat, he continued, projecting his voice with the same ringing forcefulness.
As I said earlier, we've forgotten the single most important question. Who? Who are these abominations that hound us, that skulk unseen in our most secret councils?
Just as I said,
Kinjoza seconded.
Who?
Ikuri Confis looked pointedly at Akamian, daring him to answer.
Eh, schoolman?
He'd been outmatched, Akamian realized. Confis knew his answer, knew how the others would scoff and dismiss. The consult was the stuff of children's tales and mandate madmen. He stared wordlessly at the exalt general, struggling to mask his dismay with contempt. Even with proof, they could undo him with mere words. Even with proof, they refused to believe. The man's eyes mocked him, seemed to say, "You make it too easy." Confis abruptly turned to the others.
But you've already answered my question, haven't you? When you said these things aren't the issue of sorcery, or at least any sorcery that schoolmen can see.
Kisharam,
Saban said.
You're saying these things are Kisharam?
In his periphery, Akamian could see Proyas glaring at him in alarm.
Why don't you speak?
But an exhaustion had welled through him, a numbing sense of defeat. In his soul's eye, he saw Esmanet beseeching him, her gaze alien with heartbreaking thoughts, treacherous desires.
How could this happen?
What else could they be?
Confis asked, the very voice of sober reason.
You saw it.
Aye,
Kinjoza said, his eyes strangely hesitant.
They belong to the eyeless ones, the snakeheads. There can be no other explanation.
Indeed,
Confis said, his voice resonating with oratorical gravity.
The man the Zaudunyani called the warrior prophet, the liar who came to us claiming the privileges of a prince, is an agent of the Kisharam, sent to corrupt us, to sow dissension among us, to destroy the holy war.
And he succeeded,
Gothyelk cried out in dismay.
On all points!
Denials and lamentations shivered through the air. But doom, Akamian knew, had drawn its circle far beyond Karaskan's walls.
I must find some way.
If Kellis,
Proyas shouted, commanding the room with rarity of his voice.
If Kellis is a Kisharam agent, then why did he save us in the desert?
Akamian turned to his former student, heartened.
To save his own skin,
the exalt general snapped impatiently.
Why else? As much as you distrust my wiles, Proyas, you must believe me on this. Anassarimba Kellis is a Kishorum spy. We've been watching him ever since Momum, ever since his wandering eye revealed Skaeus to my uncle.
What do you mean? Akamian blurted. The Exalt General looked to him contemptuously.
How do you think my uncle, the glorious emperor of these lands, identified Skaeus as a spy? He saw your warrior prophet exchanging glances far out of proportion to their acquaintance. He's not,
Akamian found himself shouting, my warrior prophet. He looked about, blinking, as shocked by his outburst as the others around the table. All this time, he could see them from the very beginning. And yet, the man had said nothing. Throughout the march, throughout their endless discussions of the past and the present, Kellis had known about the skin spies. Heedless of the caste noble's scrutiny, Akamian gasped for breath, clutched his chest. Dread pimpled his skin. Suddenly, so many of Kellis's questions, especially those regarding the consult and the no-god, made a different kind of sense. He was working me, using me for my knowledge, trying to understand what it was he saw. And he saw Esmanet's soft lips parting about those words, those impossible words. I carry his child. How? How could she betray him? He could remember those nights, lying side by side in the darkness of his poor tent, feeling her slender back against his chest and smiling at the press of her toes, which she always pushed between his calves when they were frigid. 10 little toes, each as cold as a raindrop. He could remember the wan yet breathless wonder that would seep through him. How could such a beauty choose him? How could this woman, this world, feel safe in his wretched arms? The air would be warm with her exhalations, while beyond the stained canvas, across 1,000 silent miles, everything would become strange and chill, and he would clutch her as though they both plummeted. And he would curse himself, thinking, don't be a fool. She's here. She swore you'd never be alone. But he was. He was alone. He blinked absurd tears from his eyes. Even his mule Daybreak was dead. He looked to the great names who watched him from about the table. He felt no shame. The Scarlet Spires had carved that from him, or so it seemed. Only desolation, doubt, and hatred. He did it. He took her. Akamian remembered Nozera, in what seemed another lifetime, asking him if the life of Inrau, his student, was worth the apocalypse. He'd conceded then, had admitted, that no man, no love was worth such a risk. And here he'd conceded once again. He would save the man who had halved his heart, because his heart was not worth the world, not worth the second apocalypse. Was it? Was it? Akamian had slept only a short while the previous night, dozing while Proyas slumbered. And for the first time since becoming a sorcerer of rank within the Mandate, there had been no dreams of the old wars. He had dreamed, rather, of Kellis and Esmanet gasping and laughing in sweaty sheets. Sitting speechless before the great names, Drusus Akamian realized that he held his heart in one hand and Apocalypse in the other. And as he hefted them in his soul, it seemed that he couldn't tell which was the heavier. It was no different for these men. The Holy War suffered, and someone must die, even if it meant the world. They were only one small pocket of confrontation amid 1,000 of such pockets scrawling across the Kalal, but they were, Nayor knew, the center all the same. Dozens of Shrial knights milled about them, their faces blank and guarded, their eyes wide with looks of worried concentration. Something was about to happen.
But he must die, Grandmaster, Sarcellus cried. Kill him and save the Holy War!
Gotian glanced nervously at Nayor before looking back to his knight commander. He ran thick fingers through his short, graying hair. Nayor had always thought the Shrial Grandmaster a decisive man, but he seemed old and unsure now, even cowed in some strange way by his subordinate's zeal. All the men of the Tusk had suffered, some more than others, and some in different ways than others. Gotian, it seemed, bore his scars on his spirit.
I appreciate your concern, Sarcellus, but it has been agreed that—
But that's just my point, Grandmaster. This sorcerer offers the great names reasons to spare the deceiver. He gives them incentives, contrived stories of evil spies that only the deceiver can see.
What do you mean? Nayor snapped. That only he can see them.
Sarcellus turned to him in a manner that smelled wary, though nothing about him appeared troubled.
This is what the sorcerer argues, he said in a sneering tone.
Perhaps he does, Nayor replied. But I followed you from the council chamber. The sorcerer had said only that there were spies in our midst, nothing more.
Are you suggesting, Gotian asked sharply, that my knight commander is lying?
No,
Nayor replied with a shrug. He felt the deadly calm settle about him.
I merely ask how he knows what he did not hear.
You're a heathen dog, Skilvendi, Sarcellus declared. A heathen! By what's right and holy, you should be rotting with a Kianine of Karaskand, not calling the word of a Shrial knight into question.
With a feral grin, Nayor spat between Sarcellus's booted feet. Over the man's shoulder, he saw the great tree, glimpsed Serwe's willowy corpse bound upside down to the Dunyain, like dead nailed to dead.
Let it be now.
A series of cries erupted from the nearby crowds. Distracted, Gotian commanded both Nayor and Sarcellus to lower their hands from their pommels. Neither man complied. Sarcellus glanced to Gotian, who peered across the crowd, then back to Nayor.
You know not what you do, Skilvendi.
His face, flexed, twitched like a dying insect.
You know not what you do.
Nayor stared in horror, hearing the madness of Anwarat in the surrounding roar.
Lie made flesh.
Shouts added to shouts until the air fairly hissed with cries and howls. Following Gotian's gaze, Nayor turned and glimpsed a cohort of scale-armored men in blue and scarlet coats through the screen of Shrial Knights, a few at first, clearing away throngs of Enrithi, then hundreds more, forming almost cheek-to-jowl opposite Gotian's men. So far, no blades had been drawn. Gotian hurried along his ranks, shouting orders, bellowing to the barracks for reinforcements. Swords were drawn, flourished, so they flashed in the sun. More of the strange warriors approached, a deep phalanx of them shoving their way through the crowds of Gaunt Enrithi. They were Javra, Nayor realized. The slave soldiers of the Scarlet Spires. What was happening here? The masses surged about several brawls. Swords rang and clattered off to the left. Gotian's cries pierced the din. Bewildered, the ranks of Shrial Knights immediately before Nayor suddenly broke, rolled back by Javra with brandished broadswords. United by shock, both Nayor and Sarcellus drew their swords. But the slave soldiers halted before them, making way for the sudden appearance of a dozen emaciated slaves bearing a silk and gauze-draped palanquin with an intricately carved black lacquered frame. In one rehearsed motion, the cadaverous men lowered the litter to the ground. A sudden hush fell over the crowds, so absolute Nayor thought he could hear the wind rattle and click through Umiaki behind him. Somewhere in the distance, some wretch shrieked, either wounded or dying. Dressed in voluminous crimson gowns, an old man stepped from the shrouded litter, looking about with imperious contempt. The breeze wafted through his silky white beard. His eyes glittered dark from beneath painted brows.
I am Eleazarus,
he declared in a resonant patrician's voice,
Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires.
He glanced over the dumbstruck crowds, then leveled his hawkish eyes on Gotian.
The one who calls himself the warrior prophet. You will cut him down and deliver him to me.
Well, it seems the matter is settled,
Icuriconfus said, his solemn tone belied by the hyena laughing in his gaze.
Akka?
Proyas whispered. Akkamian looked to him, bewildered. For a moment, the prince had sounded 12. It was strange the way memory cared nothing for the form of the past. Perhaps this was why those dying of old age were so often incredulous. Through memory, the past assailed the present, not in queues arranged by calendar and chronicle, but as a hungry mob of yesterdays. Yesterday, Esmonette had loved him. Just yesterday, she'd begged him not to leave her, not to go to the Seriotic Library. For the rest of his life, he realized, it would always be yesterday. He looked to the entryway, his attention caught by movement in his periphery. It was Zynemus. One of Proyas's men, Orissus, he realized, led him across the threshold, then up into the packed tiers. He was dressed in full panoply, wearing the shin-length skirt of a Conryan knight and a harness of silver ring mail beneath a Chianine vest. His beard was oiled and braided and fell in a fan of ringlets across his upper chest. Compared with the half-wasted men of the Tusk, he looked robust, majestic, at once exotic and familiar, like an Enrithi prince from faraway Nilnamesh. The marshal stumbled twice passing through his fellow caste nobles, and Akamian could see torment on his blinded face. Torment, and a curious, almost heartbreaking stubbornness, a determination to resume his place among the mighty. Akamian swallowed at the knife in his throat.
Sin?
Breathless, he watched the marshal settle between Gaedeki and Ingaiaban, then turn his face to open air, staring out as though the great name sat before him rather than below. Akamian remembered the indolent nights he'd spent at Zynemus's coastal villa in Conraya. He remembered drinking anpoi, eating wild hen stuffed with oysters, and their endless talk of things ancient and dead. And suddenly Akamian understood what he had to do. He had to tell a story. Esmonette had loved him just yesterday, but then so too had the world ended.
"I've suffered,"
he called abruptly, and it seemed he heard his voice through Zynemus's ears. It sounded strong.
"I have suffered," he repeated, pushing himself to his feet. "All of us have suffered. The time for politics and posturing has passed. Those who speak truth, the latter prophet tells us, have naught to fear, though they should perish for it."
He could feel their eyes, skeptical, curious, and indignant.
"It surprises you, doesn't it, hearing a sorcerer, one of the unclean, quoting scripture? I imagine it even offends some of you. Nevertheless, I shall speak the truth."
"So you lied to us before?"
Confis said, with the semblance of somber tact. Always a true son of House Icuri.
"No more than you," Akamian said, "nor any other man in these chambers. For all of us parse and ration our words, pitch them to the ears of the listener. All of us play Janann, that cursed game. Even though men die, we play it. And few, Exalt General, know it better than you."
Somehow he'd found that tone or note that stilled tongues and stirred hearts to listen. That voice, he realized, that Kellis so effortlessly mastered.
"Men think us Mandate schoolmen drunk on legend, deranged by history. All the three seas laugh at us, and why not, when we weep and tug on our beards at the tales you tell your children at night? But this isn't the three seas. This is Karaskand, where the Holy War lies trapped and starving, besieged by the fury of the Padiraja. In all likelihood, these are the last days of your life. Think on it! The hunger, the desperation, the terror flailing at your bowel, the horror bolting through your heart.
That's enough!"
an ashen-faced Gathiel cried.
"No!"
Akamian boomed.
"It isn't enough! For what you suffer now, I've suffered my entire life, day and night. Doom! Doom lies upon you, darkening your thoughts, weighing your steps. Even now your heart quickens, your breath grows tight.
But you've still much, much to learn.
Thousands of years ago, before men had crossed the great Kyarsis, before even the Chronicle of the Tusk was written, the non-men ruled these lands. And like us, they warred amongst themselves for honor, for riches, and yes, even for faith. But the greatest of their wars they fought, not against themselves or even against our ancestors, though we would prove to be their ruin,
The greatest of their wars they fought against the Inkoroi, a race of monstrosities, a race who exulted in the subtleties of the flesh, forging perversities from life the way we forge swords from iron. Srank, Basrag, even Raku, dragons, are relics of their ancient wars against the non-men. Led by the great Kujara Kinmoy, the non-men kings battled them across the plains and through the high and deep places of the earth. After ordeal and grievous sacrifice, they beat the Inkoroi back to their first and final stronghold, a place the non-men called Min Uroikas, the Pit of Obscenities. I'll not recount the horrors of that place. Suffice to say, the Inkoroi were overthrown, extinguished, or so it was thought. And the non-men cast a glamour about Min Uroikas so that it would remain forever hidden. Then, exhausted and mortally weakened, they retired to the remnants of their ruined world, a triumphant yet broken race. Centuries later, the men of Iana descended the Kyarsis, howling multitudes of them, led by their chieftain kings, our fathers of yore. You know their names, for they're enumerated in the Chronicle of the Tusk. Shelgel, Mamema, Namur, Inshul. They swept the dwindling non-men before them, sealing up their great mansions and driving them into the sea. For an age, knowledge of the Inkoroi and Min Uroikas passed from all souls. Only the non-men of Injur Nias remembered, and they dared not leave their mountain fastnesses. But as the years passed, the enmity between our races waned. Treaties were forged between the remaining non-men and the Norsarai of Trici and Soglish. Knowledge and goods were exchanged, and men learned for the first time of the Inkoroi and their wars against the non-men. Then, under the heirs of Ninkeru Teleser, a non-men sorcerer named Ket Ingira, whom you know as Makaratrig from the sagas, revealed the location of Min Uroikas to Sheonanra, the Grand Vizier of the ancient Gnostic schools of Mengik'a. The glamour about the wicked stronghold was broken, and the schoolmen of the Mengik'a reclaimed Min Uroikas to the woe of us all. They called it Enokirwa, horns reaching, though to the men who warred against them, it came to be called Golgotharoth, a name we use to frighten our children still, though it is we who should be frightened. He paused, searching from face to face. I say this because the non-men, even though they destroyed the Inkoroi, could not undo Min Uroikas, for it isn't of this world. The Mengik'a ransacked the place, discovering much that the non-men had overlooked, including terrible armaments never brought to fruition. And much as a man who dwells in a palace comes to think himself a prince, so the Mengik'a came to think themselves the successors of the Inkoroi. They became enamored of their inhuman ways, and they fell upon their obscene and degenerate craft, the Techni, with the curiosity of monkeys. And most importantly, most tragically, they discovered Mog Farao. The No-God, Proya said quietly. Akamian nodded. Tsuruma, Musiris, Worldbreaker, and a thousand other hated names. It took them centuries, but just over 2,000 years ago, when the High Kings of Kyrenius exacted tribute from these lands, and perhaps raised this very council hall, they finally succeeded in awakening him, the No-God. Near all the world crashed into screams and blood ere his fall. He smiled and looked at them, blinked tears across his cheeks. What I've seen in my dreams, he said softly. The horrors I have seen. He shook his head, stepped forward as though stumbling clear of some trance. Who among you forgets the plains of Mengeta? Many of you I know suffered nightmares, dreams of dying in ancient battles, and all of you saw the bones and bronze arms vomited from that cursed ground. Those things happened, I assure you, for a reason. They are the echoes of terrible deeds, the spore of dread and catastrophe. If any of you doubt the existence or the power of the No-God, then I bid you only recall that ground which broke for the mere witness of his passing. Now everything I've told you is fact, recorded in annals of both men and non-men. But this isn't, as you might think, a story of doom averted. Not in the least. For though Mog-Pharah was struck down on the plains of Mangetta, his accursed attendants recovered his remains. And this, great lords, is why we mandate schoolmen haunt your courts and wander your halls. This is why we bear your taunts and bite our tongues. For 2,000 years, the consult has continued its wicked study. For 2,000 years, they've labored to resurrect the no-god. Think us mad, call us fools, but it's your wives, your children we seek to protect. The 3 C's is our charge. This is why I come to you now. Heed me! For I know of what I speak. These creatures, these skin spies, that infiltrate your ranks have no relation to the Kishorim. By calling them such, you simply do what all men do when assailed by the unknown. You drag it into the circle of what you know. You clothe new enemies in the trappings of old. But these things hail from far outside your circle, from time out of memory. Think of what we saw moments ago. These skin spies are beyond your craft or ken, beyond that even of the Kishorim, whom you fear and hate. They are agents of the consult, and their mere existence omens disaster. Only deep mastery of the technique could bring such obscenities to life. A mastery that promises the resurrection of Mog-Pharah is nigh. Need I tell you what that means? We mandate schoolmen, as you know, dream of the ancient world's end. And of all those dreams, there's one we suffer more than any other, the death of Kel'Momas, High King of Kunayuri, on the fields of Eleniot. He paused, realized that he panted for breath. Anassarimber, Kel'Momas, he said. There was an anxious rustle through the chamber. He heard someone muttering in Einanai. And in this dream, he continued, pressing his tone nearer to its crescendo, Kel'Momas speaks, as the dying sometimes do, a great prophecy. Do not grieve, he says, for an Anassarimber shall return at the end of the world. An Anassarimber, he cried, as though that name held the secret of all reason. His voice resounded through the chamber, echoed across the ancient stonework. An Anassarimber shall return at the end of the world, and he has. He hangs dying even as we speak. Anassarimber Kellis, the man you've condemned, is what we in the Mandate call the Harbinger, the living sign of the end of days. He is our only hope. Akamian swept his gaze from the table to the tiers, lowered his opened palms. So you, the lords of the Holy War, must ask yourself, what's the wager you would make? You, who think yourselves doomed and your wives and children safe, are you so certain this man is merely what you think? And whence comes this certainty? From wisdom or from desperation? Are you willing to risk the very world to see your bigotries through? The silence that closed about his voice was leaden. It was as though a wall of stone faces and glass eyes regarded him. For a long moment, no one dared speak, and with startled wonder, Akamian realized he had actually reached them. For once, they'd listened with their hearts. They believe. Then Ikuri Confis began stamping his foot and slapping his thigh, calling, Hussar! Hussar! Another on the tiers, General Sampas, joined him.
Hussar! Hussar!
A mockery of the traditional Nansur cheer. The laughter was hesitant at first, but within moments, it boomed through the chamber. The lords of the Holy War had made their wager. His crimson gown shimmering in the sunlight, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires took 2 steps toward them.
You will deliver him, he repeated darkly.
Sarcellus!
Inkiri Gotian roared, brandishing a koray in his left hand.
Kill him! Kill the false prophet!
But Nayur was already sprinting toward the tree. He whirled, falling into stance several paces before the Knight of the Tusk.
Anything, any indignity, any price!
Sarcellus lowered his sword, opened his arms as though in fellowship. Beyond him, the masses surged and howled across the reaches of the Kalal. The air hummed with their growing thunder. Smiling, the Knight Commander stepped closer, pausing at the extreme limit of any sudden lunge.
We worship the same god, you and I.
The breeze had calmed, and the sun's heat leapt into its wake. It seemed to Nayor that he could smell rotting flesh. Rotting flesh mingled with a bitter spit of eucalyptus leaves.
Serwe, this, Nayor said calmly, is the sum of my worship. Rest, my sweet, for I shall bear you.
He clutched his tunic about its blood-clotted collar, tore it to his waist. He raised his broadsword straight before him.
I shall avenge.
Beyond the Knight Commander, Gotian exchanged shouts with a crimson-gowned Grand Master. The Javra, the slave soldiers of the Scarlet Spires, threw themselves against the ranks of Shrial Knights, who'd linked arms in an effort to hold them, and the surrounding fields of shrieking and bellowing Enrithi at bay. The surrounding temples and cloisters of Kasakas reared in the distance, impassive in the haze. The Five Heights loomed against the surrounding sky. And Nayor grinned as only a chieftain of the Utamot could grin. The neck of the world, it seemed, lay pressed against the point of his sword.
I shall butcher.
All hungered here, all starved. Everything Nayor realized had transpired according to the Dunyane's mad gambit. What difference did it make whether he perished now, hanging from this tree, or several days hence, when the Padiraja at last overcame the walls? So he'd given himself to his captors, knowing that no man was so innocent as the accused who exposed his accusers, knowing that if he survived, the secret of battle. Sarcella swept his long sword in a series of blinding exercises. His arms snapped out and down like bolts thrown from siege engines. There was something inhuman to his movements. Nayor neither flinched nor moved. He was a son of the people, a prodigy born of desolate earth, sent to kill, to reave. He was a savage from dark northern plains, with thunder in his heart and murder in his eyes. He was Nayor Ur-Skiotha, most violent of all men. He shrugged his bronzed limbs and planted his feet.
You will fear, Sarcella said, before this is over. I cut you once, Nayor grated.
He could clearly see the threads of inflamed red branching across his face now. They were creases, he realized, creases he'd seen open before.
I know why you loved her, the Shrial Knight snarled. Such a peach. I think I'll chase the dogs from her corpse after and love her again.
Nayor stared, unmoved. Howls rifled the air. Upraised fists hammered the distances, thousands of them. Just the space of breaths between them now. Breaths. Their blades cut open space, kissed, circled, kissed again, whirling geometries, shocking the air with a staccato ring of steel. Leap, crouch, lunge. With bestial grace, the Skilvendi pounded the abomination, pressing him back. But the Shrial Knight's sword was sorcery. It dazzled the air. Nayor fell back, gathered his breath, shook sweat from his mane.
My flesh, Sarcellus whispered, has been folded more times than the steel of your sword.
He laughed as though utterly unwinded.
Men are dogs and kine. But my kind, we're wolves in the forest, lions on the plain, we're sharks in the sea.
Emptiness always laughed. Nayor charged the creature, his sword pummeling the space between them, faint, then a breathtaking sweep. The Shrial Knight leapt, batted away the thunder of his steel. Iron honed to the absence of surface, sketching circles and points in the air, reaching, probing. They locked hilts, leaned against each other. Nayor heaved, but the man seemed immovable.
Such talent!
Sarcellus cried. Concussion in his face. How? Nayor stumbled across leaves and hot stone, rolled to his feet. He glimpsed Umiaki, clutching the sun with a tree's crone fingers. Then Sarcellus's blade was everywhere, cutting, hammering down his guard. A string of desperation saved his life. He leapt clear. The famished mobs yammered and shrieked, The very ground thrummed beneath his sandals. Exhaustion and stings, the weight of old wounds. Their blades scissored, winced apart, brushed sweaty skin, then circled round the sun. Like teeth, they clacked and gnashed. Lathered in sweat, each breath a knife in his chest. Pressed to the bowers of Umiaki, he glimpsed Serwe sagging against the Dunyane, her face black and bent back, her teeth leering from shrunken lips. The surrounding riot thinned. The boundaries between him, the ground and the black tree crumbled. Something filled him, swept him forward, unleashed his corded arms, and he howled, the very mouth of the step, his sword raping the air between. One, two, three, blows that could have halved bulls. Sarcellus faltered, stumbled, saved himself with an inhuman leap, back, pirouetting through the air, landing in a crouch. The smile was gone. His black mane ribboned by sweat, his chest heaving over the hollow of his belly, Neyor raised his arms to the tumultuous mobs.
Who? He screamed. Who will take the knife to my heart?
Again he fell upon the Shrile Knight, battered him back from the shadows of Umiaki, from the leaves curled about palmed water. But even as the man's style crumbled beneath his frothing attack, it revealed something beautiful in its precision, as beautiful as it was unconquerable. Suddenly, Sarcellus was swatting his blade as though it were a game. The man's longsword became a glittering wind, scoring his cheek, clipping his shin. Neyor fell back, wailed rabid frustration, bellowed defiance. A sword tip sheared through his thigh. He skidded in blood, fell forward, bare throat exposed, stone bruised his bones, grit gouged his skin.
No.
A powerful voice pierced the roar of the holy war.
Sarcellus!
It was Gotian. He'd broken with Eleazarus, and was warily approaching his zealous knight commander. The crowds abruptly grew subdued.
Sarcellus!
The Grand Master's eyes were slack with disbelief.
Where?
A hesitant swallow.
Where did you learn to fight so?
The Knight of the Tusk whirled, his face the very mask of reverent subservience.
My lord, I've...
Sarcellus suddenly convulsed, coughed blood through gritted teeth. Neyor guided his thrashing body to the ground with his sword. Then, within reach of the dumbstruck Grand Master, he hacked off its head with a single stroke. He gathered the thick maul of black hair in his hand, raised the severed head high, like bowels from a split belly. Its face relaxed, opened like a harem of limbs. Gotian fell to his knees. Eleazarus stumbled back into his slaves. The mob's thunder, horror, exultation broke across the Skilvendi, the riot of revelation. He tossed the hoary thing at the sorcerer's feet.